Welcome to the podcast of America This Week, courtesy of the Catholic Channel on Sirius XM 129. If you want to listen to more, subscribe to Sirius XM and tune in on Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Eastern on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129. Now, back to America This Week, live with Father Matt Malone and Carrie Weber.
Welcome back. I'm Carrie Weber, and I'm joined today, as always, by Father Matt Malone, and we also have Kevin Clark, one of our senior editors here in the house. We are America This Week, and you're listening to Sirius XM 129. We're going to be speaking with one of our contributing editors, Stephanie Slade, who is a managing editor over at Reason, a libertarian magazine of free minds and free markets. And she's also a contributing writer, as I said, for us at America. And she wrote about Catholic hospitals, Catholic healthcare, and the ACLU. And this was in our sort of special Catholic healthcare issue, which, Kevin, you were also a contributor to. People can find his piece, "When the Sick and Marginalized Are Left Behind, It's Catholic Healthcare Providers Who Bring Hope." And you had a chance to talk to some of the providers and talk to some of the folks who are recipients of this care and presumably hope, talk about the ways in which Catholic healthcare is sort of stepping into the margins and where people are often sort of falling through the cracks. Do you want to talk a little bit about some of the stories that came out of that most moved you?
Well, I would say first, if I can comment on Stephanie's piece, one of the great challenges that the piece raises is if Catholic hospitals weren't out there plugging these holes in the U.S.'s healthcare delivery system, who would be doing it? And of course, this Stephanie's dealing with the ACLU and Merger Watch and some of the other agencies who are very critical of the presence of Catholic healthcare. My article says, you know, this is why they're so necessary, because this is not a place where for-profit healthcare is going to step in, and very few other faiths or denominations have the history in providing healthcare that the Catholic Church in the United States does. This has been something we've been doing since we arrived here in the 19th century, and these facilities have grown out of these historic mission efforts, mostly by Catholic women religious over the years. In fact, I think the lion's share of these Catholic health networks were built by religious women beginning in the 19th century. And they're still doing the same mission, the same service. They're going to those places where other people are not going, and they're providing the care that is so acutely needed. I mean, life-saving care, really. And this is going to hopefully continue for another century. But it was not hard for me to find these kinds of stories. The idea was that we'd look for, I mean, it's kind of, I don't want to be condescending, and, you know, how are you define the marginalized people in the United States? Historically, as journalists, we look at the peripheries by class, by income, by geography, and you can find a Catholic health network in every one of those marginal places, trying to do what they can,
and often in a really holistic way. You know, looking at the whole person and not just a single aspect of someone's health, but trying to address it systemically.
Well, yeah, that's something I learned through this. You know, one of the great things about being a journalist is when you often are given an assignment, you have no idea what you're doing. So you get to learn all about a whole new subject. So this idea, which I thought is quite interesting, is so many of these institutions are getting beyond what you would consider a health mission. Everyone I dealt with here in this article were doing outreach to the homeless. They were doing outreach to undocumented people. They were doing outreach to communities in distress, looking for different ways to shore up those communities, whether it's through job development or retraining or housing, low-income housing. So these are non-traditional efforts for health providers to be involved with. But they assured me this is the best way to ensure personal health, individual health is taking a shot at shoring up community health.
And you spoke to one of the leaders of a acute care facility in West Baltimore, who said that really, overall health, longevity, quality of life, 20% of it is your parents, which you don't control. 10% is access to health care, but 70% has to do with these social determinants.
And that seems to be something that the
church recognized a century ago when it really began this work in earnest, and located these hospitals precisely in those places that were most socially compromised.
Yeah. Well, and Dr. Ross talked about his institution actually trying to find a way to be the stabilizing employment force for West Baltimore, you know, and making that part of the holistic, comprehensive approach they have to dealing with personal health, individual health. What I talked to him about, which I thought was quite interesting, was their efforts to reintegrate people coming out of the Maryland prison system, many of whom are being sort of reintroduced to West Baltimore. I don't know enough about how Maryland does it, but perhaps with not as much support as they could use. What Bonsecours is doing in West Baltimore is they've created an outreach program to help these young men and women, whether they've been in prison or jail for a year or 40 years, to reintegrate themselves into society and not end up heading back to jail, which is so often, sadly, what happens to people who are not given the proper supports when they come out of the jail system.
Do they worry at all about some kind of mission creep, you know, of taking too comprehensive an approach and losing focus on their core?
It doesn't seem as if they're too concerned about that. He mentioned that they're providing low-income housing. Mm-hmm. They do things like job retraining. They have tutoring for kids. I'd say if the mission creep was a threat, it's already been realized.
It's already been realized.
It's fully creeped. So they're doing a lot in West Baltimore.
Yeah, and Circle the City, a program you mentioned in Phoenix, is a really powerful example as well of serving people on the margins of, you know, recognizing that people who are homeless don't have somewhere to recover necessarily from health treatment and creating places where they can go after treatment to heal.
Well, it seems obvious, right? I mean, when you hear that, you're like, well, duh.
Of course
nobody thought of this before. But, you know, I don't know if, like, New York has a similar program in any other large city. What Sister Adele O'Sullivan, who was absolutely charming, by the way, and the guy I interviewed, oh, man, he loved her. He could not stop talking about her.
And she herself is a physician.
Yeah. She came up with the idea, after seeing too many homeless people end up right back on the streets after a serious injury or a serious illness with no time to recuperate, and just beginning a spiral of even worse personal health outcomes, she thought what this community needs is just a respite area, a respite care facility for homeless people. And she said it was very easy when she got the idea codified a little bit and put it out there. For support, she said money came in from all quarters, from all different communities in Phoenix. Income, whether differentiated by income or religion or race, people just gave her the cash because they saw this was just such an obvious need. And she was able to build a state-of-the-art, I think it's a 50-bed facility. She could double the size of it overnight, she said, and they still would have a need for it. But what it does give people who are homeless, who don't have anyone to take care of them after they're recovering from a surgery or an illness, it gives them a place to go. And she said before that, the hospitals would send people just out, right back out onto the street. People would show up at shelters in hospital gowns, stepping out of taxis. And the shelter staff had no training or capacity to deal with that kind of recovery time. So you were just setting people up to get much worse, perhaps even to die on the streets by themselves.
Well, as you pointed out, Carrie, that article by Kevin appears in the May 23rd, 2017 issue of America. It's called When the Sick and Marginalized Are Left Behind. It's Catholic Healthcare Providers Who Bring Hope.
And I want to give a shout out to whoever put the Irish lilt into that headline. You know, like, there's a little aspect of tense going on.
Yeah, indeed. So if it is the Catholic healthcare system who brings hope, then Stephanie Slade wanted to ask, why is the ACLU targeting Catholic hospitals? And Stephanie Slade, our contributing writer, joins us now on the line. Hello, Stephanie.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So you have written a piece in the same special healthcare issue, the title of which is Why is the ACLU Targeting Catholic Hospitals? So why are they?
That's a great question, and I don't necessarily have an answer to that. I was looking at the history of Catholic healthcare, especially here in the United States, and what are the threats that it faces in this sort of modern age. And it's unfortunate that the ACLU has become one of the main threats facing Catholic healthcare these days. The way that has sort of come to be is that the ACLU has decided that the right to get an abortion or to have a sterilization procedure, for example, for a woman to go and get her tubes tied, is a sort of fundamental American human right, and they have decided to sort of to litigate that and to try to force Catholic hospitals to go along with their views by launching a flurry of lawsuits against Catholic hospitals and against the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops to try to force these hospitals to do these procedures, which, you know, if you know anything about Catholic teaching, you know that that's not going to fly at a Catholic hospital. Catholic hospitals are governed by a document called the Ethical and Religious Directives that sort of tells medical practitioners how to apply our beliefs about, you know, the sanctity of life and the dignity of the human person to their work in the medical field. And so, of course, you know, no surprise, that means no committing abortions, no committing direct abortions, no committing elective sterilization procedures. That would just fly in the face of everything that we believe and everything the church teaches. But the ACLU has decided that counts as discrimination against women and that it's worth spending their finite resources to repeatedly bring those lawsuits to try to force that to happen anyway.
And a lot of the lawsuits and the conflicts come in places that do in fact serve the margins. The argument is that a Catholic hospital in a very rural area might be the only hospital for miles around, and therefore it needs to provide these services. But the solution of, you know, targeting the only hospital and trying to you know, really disrupt their service in some ways is not really going to be helpful to the people in the rural area overall.
That's right. These sort of pro-abortion interest groups, including now the ACLU sort of falls into that category, they like to point to statistics such as the number of Catholic hospitals have increased by 16% in recent years, or nowadays 1 in 6 Americans is served, you know, cared for at a Catholic hospital. And they seem to think that this is evidence for their view that as a result, these hospitals need to be forced to do what the ACLU says. Another way to look at it would be to say that Catholic hospitals are providing care in places where no one else where there is no one else to provide care. And if we start litigating against them and forcing them to divert their resources away from patients and into courtrooms to defend themselves, or worse, if they actually were to be successful in any of these lawsuits, they would essentially shut these hospitals down that they've already acknowledged as the only hospital in a particular community. That's just a terrible outcome that's going to disproportionately harm poor people, people in rural communities, people in inner cities. And that's just an incredible outcome that they don't seem to be bothered by, and that's a pretty incredible state of reality.
And it seems like the ACLU, a few years ago, you could have counted on the ACLU to perhaps take the different perspective and say that in defense of liberty, in defense of civil rights and religious freedom,
the First Amendment, right?
They might defend Catholic hospitals who might be criticized in this matter, but if they seem to have made the pro-choice banner the only flag they're willing to work under these days.
Yeah, it's really unfortunate. They hold themselves out to this day as being on the side of religious freedom, free association, free speech. And there was a time when they really were. I mean, they were, you know, one of the most famous cases they ever brought was to defend the right of the American Nazi Party to march through Skokie, right? And they're very famous for that. And their whole point was, it doesn't matter if a group's view is popular. What matters is the First Amendment. Back in the 1990s, this law called the Religious Freedom Restoration Act was passed and signed by Bill Clinton, and the ACLU were vocal supporters of that law, which was a landmark piece of legislation to protect people of faith in this country. They were pro-RFRA back then, and so it's kind of crazy to imagine, you know, it's been less than 3 decades, and how did we go from this group that was advocating for the rights of people, even with unpopular views, even if they didn't agree with the views of the groups, to live out their beliefs and to voice their opinions and to, you know, just sort of live according to their faith, to now filing this, you know, repeatedly filing lawsuits against Catholic hospitals to try to shut them down or force them to do abortions.
And soliciting cases in a number of places around. They're actively seeking new cases to apply.
That's right. They, so far, fortunately, blessedly, these cases have been unsuccessful for the ACLU. The courts have sided against the ACLU and with the Catholic hospitals and with the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops so far in all of the cases that have been decided, which is not surprising because, you know, we have a First Amendment in this country, and the First Amendment protects your right to live out your faith. But the ACLU they haven't taken the hint there. They have a website that is actively inviting people to write in with their horror stories of being turned away by Catholic hospitals. In practice, what this means is things like, one of the stories they cite as an example for their own side is in one of these reports from the ACLU, is a woman who she had complications during her pregnancy and she was cared for at a Catholic hospital. She had a scheduled cesarean section coming up, and she said, "I want to have my tubes tied when I give birth." And the Catholic hospital said, "We can't do that. We could transfer you to another hospital. If it's really important to you to have that procedure done right away, we'll transfer you to another hospital, and they can do it. But we're not going to do that here on our premises." And that, to her, was an outrage and was considered a horrifying case of being turned away, you know, by a Catholic hospital. It just doesn't really add up when you start looking into the cases themselves, which I think is why the courts have actually so far sided against the ACLU. But it's pretty frightening that they are continuing to sort of come at Catholic hospitals and looking for different angles and different cases and different legal arguments to bring in the hopes that one of these days they might find a judge that will side with them.
And disrupt the services. Right. I think there's a line of argument that they make that is a little, it's like they don't quite understand how the ERDs work. You know, first of all, they're saying there's a poorer quality of care for women, which Carol Keehan at the CHA, I know, would love to have a chat with them about. But they also seem to, they use the rhetoric of bishops making decisions in the emergency rooms and the operating theaters, and it's just not fundamentally how that works. Can you speak to that a little bit?
Yeah, and I spoke to Sister Carol Keehan, who heads the Catholic Health Association, for this piece, and she's very unhappy with what her hospitals, who are trying to save lives and are saving lives, are now having to, again, sort of divert their attention and their resources to fight off these lawsuits. It's very unfortunate, especially because, and this is the point that she makes and that I make in the piece, and that speaks to your question, these are all fully accredited hospitals. They are the licensing boards and organizations at the federal level, at the state level, have all agreed, are all uniformly in agreement that these hospitals are fully licensed, accredited, and providing all the necessary care. In a lot of communities, the high-risk maternity wards are located in Catholic hospitals. So when a woman is facing a difficult pregnancy or is at high risk for complications, other hospitals will send her to the Catholic hospital because they have sort of developed a reputation for being so excellent in that area, for such excellence. And these are the hospitals that are now being targeted. And the idea is, why does the ACLU get to decide what makes a hospital a good hospital, or what makes a hospital a legitimate and able to continue operating at all? Why, you know, since when is the ACLU the organization that gets to make that determination? No, we have plenty of other people. We have the patients themselves. We have the state and federal licensing bodies. We have the press that can bring out these stories to people's attention. So if they don't want to go to a Catholic hospital, they don't have to. But the idea that we need, this is a high enough priority issue that we need to spend time forcing these hospitals to do something they don't want to do, it's really troubling, I think, for many of these Catholic health professionals themselves, because it's not just the institution or the bishops that are being targeted. It's the doctors, it's the nurses, right, some of whom are members of religious orders themselves, and all of whom have voluntarily chosen to work at Catholic hospitals. And nobody's rights are being violated here.
I thought that one of the really great points that Sister Carol from the Catholic Health Association makes in this article is that, look, there isn't a hospital anywhere that does every procedure, right? And hospitals decide all the time which procedures they're going to perform and which ones they are not. And as she points out in her interview with you, you know, you can't go into a hospital that doesn't have a department of brain surgery and insist that they actually give you brain surgery just because they have an operating room, right?
You probably exactly wouldn't want to go to a hospital to insist on brain surgery when they didn't.
Right,
have a
but surgery. The point is, like, why these issues and why, you know, I mean, why target these people on these issues? It does seem like a double standard.
So today we're talking with Stephanie Slade, who is a contributing writer to our magazine and who has written an article for that magazine, which you can find on our website, americamagazine.org, called "Why is the ACLU Targeting Catholic Hospitals?" And One of the points that you bring up, Stephanie, is that the ACLU is sort of differentiating between civil rights and civil liberties in how they talk about these issues. And I wonder if you can kind of break that down for us.
Definitely. So the American Civil Liberties Union was historically a civil libertarian group, a group focused on maximizing people's liberties. You know, the word liberty is right there in the name. And what that means, what that really means is making sure that people are free from interference and the violation of rights by the government. So making sure that people aren't being stopped from voting, making sure that people aren't, you know, being arrested without due process or prevented from talking to a lawyer if they've been arrested or accused of a crime or something like that. Making sure that, right, even to this day, they are doing really great work on making sure that, for example, people aren't wrongfully, immigrants and refugees aren't wrongfully turned away from our country or thrown out of our country when they shouldn't be. These are all things where they're protecting individuals against the authority of the state, and that makes that's what a sort of civil libertarian is all about. But in recent years, seems to be since about 2001, when the current executive director Anthony Romero took over at the ACLU, that seems to have changed. There seems to have been a real shift away from focusing on civil liberties and toward focusing on what they call civil rights, but which in reality ends up being looking an awful lot like it's just reflecting what the values of the sort of progressive interest groups are. So they're no longer focused on the right to freely associate or freely, you know, live out your faith or, in this instance, run a hospital according to its own unique Catholic identity. Now they're focused on, are women able to force their employers to pay for their birth control? Are women able to force their Catholic hospital in their community to give them an abortion or to give them a sterilization procedure? And they're doing all of this by sort of waving the banner of women's rights and even the larger banner of civil rights. But I think that's quite a misleading characterization. I mean, I think we need to be careful to understand what we mean here. What we're actually talking about is they're supporting the right of one individual to force another individual to do something against his or her will. And I think that's a pretty dangerous and scary proposition, you know, in a free society.
What is the argument there from the ACLU side that... is it that Catholic institutions, because they accept money from government or are being paid via Medicare or Medicaid, somehow are acting as government agents and are therefore required to, you know, reach that standard of not imposing their, you know, sort of creating a religious barrier to treatment?
They might make that argument. I think they probably would make that argument, but I think it's a little bit of a false one, because if you push them on it, if you were to push them on it and say, okay, let's say Catholic hospitals, you know, hypothetically, were not accepting any government money, any Medicaid patients, if they were just purely private entities, would you then back off and leave them alone and say, okay, you can do whatever you want? No, probably not. They probably wouldn't be satisfied because their goal isn't really, I mean, that's just an excuse. I think it's pretty clear that that's mostly an excuse. And their position is women should have a right to get an abortion at any time for any reason. And any hospital that is open, that, you know, opens its doors to the public and serves people should be required to do what we say that hospital should be required to do.
Yeah, so there, and I was getting at something earlier. They seem to have a fundamental misunderstanding of how the ERDs function in a Catholic institution. In fact, when they sued the USCCB, their argument was that the bishops are making decisions about health care, which is completely erroneous. That the hospitals maintain their own ethical committees that meet and make decisions about cases. The ERDs are guides, of course, for those decisions, but it's not like you know, the local bishop is calling in emergency treatment calls at his hospital.
Yeah, and I guess another important thing to remember is that what the ERDs, the ethical and religious directives that the hospitals follow, really are a way to help the medical professionals apply the Catholic Church's teachings to these hard cases that they might face in their day-to-day work, to make it so that everybody isn't constantly having to make snap gut judgments about every hard case. You know, we can actually take the time to think about them in advance, think about the sort of moral weight and the moral questions involved, and provide guidance and help to these individual medical practitioners. It really is there to help people live out their faith and help Catholic hospitals continue sort of care for people and continue their mission to provide medical care in accordance with their very unique and beautiful Catholic identity.
Stephanie, I wonder if you can talk a little bit about the origins of that Catholic identity. There's a section in your article about the history of a lot of these Catholic hospitals and even particular women religious who were sort of instrumental in that and the founding of various hospitals. And one thing that you mention is you talk about one sister, Mother Joseph of the Sisters of Providence, who founded basically the Providence Health and Services network of hospitals, building many of them with her own hands. And one of the things you mentioned is how sort of remarkable it is that, in your own words, how remarkable about her, what is actually remarkable about her story is how unremarkable it is in the larger history of Catholic medicine, that so many women religious were really just on the forefront of this.
Yeah, I think that the history of healthcare in the United States is really almost entirely a history it's the story of Catholic healthcare and of Catholic women religious in particular, because these are, you know, every time the ACLU or another sort of progressive interest group throws out a number like, oh, the number of Catholic hospitals is spiked 16% in recent years. Well, you have to remember, you know, put this in context. In the early years of the United States, after this country's founding, there were huge swaths of the country where there was no health care at all. There was no infrastructure. There were no secular hospitals. There were no government-run hospitals. What there were Catholics willing to go, Catholic orders of, especially, again, Catholic women religious, willing to go out into these wild frontier countries or into these inner cities and establish hospitals and meet the need that they saw that was going completely unmet. In some cases, they were pretty, Mother Joseph, who you were just describing, her statue is currently at the U.S. Capitol here in Washington, D.C., as one of the two heroes of representing the state of Washington. That every state gets to pick two people and put their statues in the Capitol. And Washington has chosen Mother Joseph because she is one of the most influential people to that whole region of the Pacific Northwest. There was nothing when she went out there. There were no hospitals, there were no schools, there were no orphanages. And she built, I think, something like three dozen such institutions with her own money. She was a carpenter by trade. She built them with her own two hands in many instances. Again, it's not the case that the Catholics are sort of coming in and invading and taking over the existing American healthcare. Catholics built American healthcare as we know it, and that's an important historical reality that I think we need to keep in mind.
And so one of the questions that you ask Wendy Kaminer, who is a legal scholar and has been associated with the civil liberties movement over the years, is this anti-Catholic? I mean, they're clearly targeting Catholic hospitals and Catholic healthcare. Is it some anti-Catholic bias, or does really this shift in the internal kind of philosophical orientation of the ACLU really explain it?
It's not a question that I can answer for you definitively. Wendy Kaminer believes that there's not real anti-Catholic prejudice going on here. She believes it's more of a political question. The political commitments of the current leadership of the ACLU are just different than the organization used to have, and that's an unfortunate development, but that it's not necessarily anti-Catholic. I think there's a lot of people that would disagree with her on that and would say the evidence suggests that they have gone above and beyond what's necessary in trying to target Christian institutions, and that there is a real animus toward us and what we believe and the sort of threat we pose to the, if I may, the sort of post-sexual revolution liberal worldview that is so important to them today.
And one of those persons that might disagree with Kaminer is Hillary Burns, is the Assistant General Counsel at the USCCB, and one of the people that you interviewed for this article, who says, quote, "What they're trying to essentially force Catholic hospitals to not be Catholic anymore."
That's right. And that's a common statement that I heard from a lot of the people I interviewed within Catholic healthcare and within sort of just the Catholic world and observers, legal observers, is ultimately what they're trying to do is to drive out the church's teachings on these issues and replace them with their view of right and wrong.
It seems to be a broader secularization phenomenon, though. I mean, we're talking about, we're seeing the phenomenon of Catholic high schools sort of denuding their religious identity and reconstituting themselves as charter schools to get that that charter public school money. We're seeing other Catholic institutions already in healthcare. This is a phenomenon that's been happening. Catholic institutions who deassociate themselves from their original religious bodies as a way to get around this particular issue. Is this really the ACLU has a very specific agenda, or is this just sort of the broad-based secularization of American society that we're experiencing at work?
It's definitely not limited to just these lawsuits that I was writing about in this piece. We also, everyone here may be aware that there have been Catholic adoption agencies in a number of cities that have been forced to shut down because the cities passed laws saying you must place people with single parents and
foster care facilities, the same problem.
Right. Yeah. So it's not limited, but I think the one distinction that I always like to try to make and think it's important to make is it's one thing for a Catholic institution to choose to reorganize itself. It's a very different thing to be forced by the law, you know, to be forced out of existence by the law, or to be forced, you know, to go into a courtroom and defend your very right to exist. I think that whether the changes are voluntary versus whether they're forced upon us, that's a thing that we ought to keep in mind as well.
Is there hot spots, Stephanie, where this is particularly acute? I know the ACLU of Michigan has really made this a part of their mission to go after Catholic institutions. Are there other parts of the country where this problem is more prevalent?
Yeah, it's not limited to Michigan. There have been a number of lawsuits in California and some other states as well. One of the examples that the ACLU cites is one of their, in their view, their most egregious examples of a Catholic hospital, you know, not giving the kind of treatment they would want to a woman, was in Mercy Health Partners in I believe Little Rock, Arkansas. So it's happening all over, and it's not really they're trying to bring lawsuits, it seems to me, in as many jurisdictions in front of as many different sort of judges and using as many different legal arguments as possible. It's almost like they're throwing a bunch of things at the wall and seeing what's going to stick in the hopes that they can find one argument or sort of type of case that will get them the outcome they want. And then I think if that happens, it'll be sort of open sesame. They're going to bring a bunch more cases like that, and so this is not going anywhere.
The article is called "Why Is the ACLU Targeting Catholic Hospitals?" It's by Stephanie Slade, our contributing writer, and it can be found at www.americamagazine.org and in the print edition of May 31st, 2017. Stephanie, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you very much.
I miss Ira Glasser. You know, he was the former head of the ACLU, and he really brought the ACLU to where it is today in terms of its public position in the public debate, and you know, before this shift that she described from
civil liberties to civil rights.
And Ira Glasser, who probably would have been branded by the popular press as a liberal, he was often sitting on Bill Buckley's side of the table during those firing line debates, you know, not because they had the same ideological position, but because they had the same view of the First Amendment. Those were in those halcyon days when American politics was less consumed by ideological warfare. Yeah.
Now, unfortunately.
We've had more troubling periods, I think, though, in our past.
We have indeed.
Active warfare was one of
them. This is precisely why the Pope last week warned us against using political labels in our ecclesial dialogue, that we should never mistake the conversation that we're meant to have as Catholic Christians for the conversation, or lack thereof, that occurs in our secular culture.
Sounds like he's reading something by Father Matt Malone in American Magazine.
Maybe.
Pursuing the Truth in Love. Go check it out at
AmericanMagazine.org. Copy in Spanish. You never know.
You never know.
Right, indeed. Well, you have been listening to America This Week on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129. You can follow these stories and find out about so much more at AmericanMagazine.org. You can also follow us on Facebook and on Twitter. And to subscribe to America Magazine, call 1-800-627-9533. That's 1-800-627-9533 for a smart Catholic take on faith and culture. For Kerry Weber and Kevin Clark, I'm Father Matt Malone. Thank you and good day.
Thank you for listening to the podcast of America This Week, courtesy of the Catholic Channel on SiriusXM 129. If you want to listen to more, subscribe to SiriusXM and tune in on Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Eastern on the Catholic Channel, SiriusXM 129.